Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories for this very special interview with Richard Dutcher, the father of Mormon cinema. I'm John DeLynn. Please bear with me while I make four short but very important announcements with regard to this interview. First, these interviews are not only available in audio format, they're also available in high-definition video with footage from Richard's actual movies at youtube.com/mormonstories. Please check them out if you can. They're quite amazing. Historical, even. Second, Richard is in critical need of support for his current film project called Triptych, so please visit the website kickstarter.com during the month of October 2010 to donate. Kickstarter is a site created to help fund creative endeavors, but it requires that the funding target be completely raised before any funds change hands. Each project is given a particular number of days to reach its funding goals. In this case, it's 30 days, so time is of the essence. To learn more about the Triptych project, listen to this full interview or visit the site and type in Triptych. Triptych is spelled T-R-I-P-T-Y-C-H and or Richard Dutcher. That's kickstarter.com, K-I-C-K-starter.com. We will also have a link to Richard's Triptych fundraising page at richarddutcher.com. For those of you who do not own Richard Dutcher's movies, such as God's Army, Brigham City, or States of Grace, please consider supporting Richard's incredible filmmaking by buying the DVDs today at richarddutcher.com. That's D-U-T-C-H-E-R. These movies are fantastic, and you will enjoy these Mormon Stories interviews so much more if you've actually seen the movies. I can't recommend these movies highly enough. Finally, if you'd like to make a gift or investment to help Richard with one of his much larger film projects, including his much-discussed Joseph Smith movie, please contact him through richarddutcher.com or via Facebook. Again, the last name is spelled D-U-T-C-H-E-R. Let's do our part to help him make that Joseph Smith movie. It's his birthright. Thanks again for listening, and now on with the show. Take it away, Dan Witherspoon.
Well, Richard, thank you for all the time you've taken with us so far, and we thank our listening and viewing audience. And I found this to be a completely fascinating talk, and I'm grateful for you to being so open and sharing so much.
How many people do you think are still with us?
Well, again, we'll divide it up into different segments, and we'll describe the types of things that are on there, but I think there's rich stuff in each segment that we've covered. But I know that this last segment that we're going to do right now is really been on a lot of people's mind. You're a fascinating character in Mormon history, in a sense of at least Mormon culture. A lot of people respect your talent. They want you to still be our teammate for those who are within the Mormon struggle. And they're curious about your journey, you know, from the open-hearted sincerity of God's Army 10 years ago to someone who in the Provo Herald 7 years, or 3 years ago, so 2007, 7 years later after God's Army, sort of said, I'm done with Mormon cinema for sure. And you indicated that the church in some ways too, though you've kept somewhat quiet about your different, you know, exactly how post-Mormon you are and things like that. So appreciate your willingness in advance to talk about these things, set the record straight, to clear up any perceptions about you, to talk about your family and how they've handled this journey and as they've watched you and perhaps gone along with you in some ways too. So if we can just dig in right into your Mormonism today, or at least maybe start with how it got to, you know, the stepping stones or things that sort of show the evolution of your faith.
Okay. Yeah, this is difficult.
And you can dive in wherever you want there. That was...
Yeah, difficult to talk about. Yeah, where do you start? See, because it's such a huge and complex topic. I guess the important thing to talk about first is, I've been very reluctant to speak about it in any real depth. First of all, mostly because I don't really have the forum to talk about it in any real depth. You know, it's like somebody is writing a newspaper article and they want to talk. It's like there's no point to even beginning because, first of all, they'll just take the most provocative things and that's the only thing that'll be out there. And taken out of context, it's just it's too complex. So I haven't really talked about it. Also, I haven't talked about it much because I don't think it will do any good. Just as I used to say, you know, I you know, I'm not interested in making any more Mormons in the world. And I used to say that a lot when I was making the films. I was interested in the films and making good movies, and it wasn't about
missionary work.
And now I certainly don't want to make any fewer Mormons in the world. And also, I didn't leave with an issue. I didn't leave with I didn't leave angry. There was certainly anger there, and we'll need to talk about that. But it's always been. I mean, I loved Mormonism. I think I could say I still love Mormonism, but I certainly loved it. It was such a very important thing for me. And I love the community. I still love the community and the people. So yeah, I have zero interest in causing any kind of conflict, you know, which is really not what I'm about at all. And I have zero interest in delving into specific issues that I'm completely at peace with, but that are so contentious that, you know, it just becomes about the argument rather than about the issue or the truth claim. So yeah, it's a tricky thing to talk about. So I guess we should talk about it in the sense of we talked a little bit in the previous segment about, you know, my spiritual history in the sense of being raised Pentecostal, being brought into Mormonism by my stepfather, and that it really appealed to me, you know, intellectually and emotionally. It was a good fit, you know, for me, for my personality and my psychology. It was a great fit. And some formative experiences that happened later were, you know, there was that point when I got to be, you know, the Mormon story was very powerful. The Joseph Smith story was a very powerful, psychologically powerful story, especially for a young man you're growing up. I mean, I remember going, we lived in Kentucky for a while, and we had this great forest behind our house, and there's woods, and so I would go back there and I would pray, and I was, you know, I was fully expecting to have Moroni come, or, you know, Jesus, wouldn't that be great? And they were very sincere prayers, but that narrative was very much in my mind, and I kind of viewed, I guess, that Joseph Smith story kind of really lived in me and in my mind. And when I got to the point of being about 14, and this is all, you know, not surprising at all, but, you know, you're in Mormonism, you're encouraged so strongly to get your own testimony, you know, to pray and read the Book of Mormon. And I was, as a kid, I was the most studious young Mormon that I knew. You know, I'd read the Old Testament. By the time I went on my mission, I'd read the Old Testament twice, the New Testament several times, Book of Mormon so many times, the Doctrine and Covenants. I wasn't one of these missionaries that went in unprepared. I knew it all. I knew it all. But
you were well prepared.
I was very well read, you know. And so, but at 14, it was important to me to get that testimony. And so I was just following along in the pattern that had been said. A lot of praying, a lot of scriptures, and but I did have a really powerful experience. That there are a few experiences in my life that, in my post-Mormonism, I've had to really look at, you know, it's like, and really examine and, you know, recognize that these were genuine experiences. What did they mean? And how does that fit into my current worldview? And one of those experiences was during this period where I was searching and, you know, reading and praying and wanting a testimony and not really getting anything. And then my family went to, for a Nauvoo Carthage vacation, and I went through the Carthage jail, and that experience I put into the experience of Elder Banks, the black missionary in God's Army.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
But it was my experience of being there, and very, you know, I was just there doing the tourist thing and sitting in that room and listening to what had happened, and it just moved me so powerfully. I was just overcome with emotion, and I was fighting back tears, and I really did feel like, the way I described it in God's Army, was like the Holy Spirit just walked in and sat down in my body, and I was so filled with light and love and sorrow for what had happened and everything. And of course, my interpretation of that was, I've seen the light, I've had the experience, the church is true, Joseph Smith was a prophet,
extrapolate from this to everything's true.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That was a very specific moment.
And it was such a real and a genuine experience, and something that I didn't feel like I was, generating. It's just something that happened. Mm-hmm. And so that, and that's what carried me through my teenage years and everything. You know, I spoke briefly about the, you know, I had a little bit of a rebellious, independent phase. And then everybody was surprised when I decided to go on a mission, but because of the experience with Return of the Jedi or whatever, that...
And it just dawned on me when you said George Lucas, your oldest son is named Lucas. Was that...
Yeah, but it's honestly not. It's honestly not. But it's a nice correlation. But no, that's not why he's named Lucas. But so that was an experience. And of course, in the mission field, I had so many really fantastic experiences that just always seemed to confirm that I was doing the right thing and right place. And I was a very sincere missionary. I was very, I believed, I worked hard, and was really seeking, you know, even as a missionary, I was still seeking God and seeking experiences where I could feel that divine connection, which was really important to me. And there were times when, like I remember a father of a couple that we were teaching, which now that I'm thinking about it, the young girl and her sister were the characters, became characters in God's Army later, and the father was, he was battling alcoholism and he had a throat cancer, I believe. But he needed a blessing, and there was one particularly just powerful, beautiful blessing when he requested a blessing, and it was just such a beautiful moment, just full of love and light, and I really honestly felt like I was a conduit of something divine, and it was just a beautiful experience. And there were things like that, you know, that would come along, and experiences of light and darkness. And, well, you want to talk about this, and you know, you and I have talked because we're friends, and so one time we were sharing these odd experiences that we were having, and I do have an experience that I don't want to go into it too deeply because it's actually going to crop up in a film at a future point, a very, very crucial point, but just in broad strokes. There was a period when I was, I think I was about 16 years old, and my parents had moved away. They'd moved back to Kansas. I had decided to stay in Utah, so I was going to be like basically homeless, living with friends or whoever would take me in so that I could finish high school. And I was actually just spending the night in our vacant house, and my friend was there, and we were sleeping in the backyard. And I was feeling guilty about my teenage sins, you know, and my rebelliousness, and I go into the house to have a moment alone so I could pray and ask forgiveness. And it was a freaky experience that I've always... I'm still trying to kind of explain, but sitting, you know, knelt in a corner of an empty room, in the empty front room of this empty house, vacant house, started praying and decided I better pray out loud. So as I started to pray out loud, suddenly there was the doors. I mean, it was such an exaggerated event where it was like there were two big double doors that were the front entrance to the house, and they were just like throwing back and forth like some very large man was, you know, trying to break in. And it was just like, bam, scared the hell out of me. I mean, just instantly. And you know, I felt at the time, as soon as that was happening, there were picture windows that you could kind of, I could have seen somebody there or at least a shadow of someone, and there was nothing there. Scared the hell out of me. And instantly I just felt like I was, you know, surrounded by some very malicious energy. And so I just knew that something that, and could have been in my mind, you know, it could have been generated by the fear of this, and my instant interpretation that I was praying, trying to repent. Here was something really.
Now you're odd about to happening. Have the Joseph Smith experience,
right.
Maybe.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I instantly interpreted, but I just felt that way, and I felt like I had to get out, and so I just got up and you know, got my behind out of the house and went to my friend who was still asleep in the backyard, and he was like, "Welcome." I was, you know, terrified. By this time, I was just so terrified. And then he immediately became terrified. And he was he was LDS, but not active at all. And so then, you know, I went around to the front to see if anything could have happened, just trying to find some physical explanation of what had just happened. Of course, there's nothing there and no one there. And it was such a completely odd experience. And so I've often tried to make sense of that because it really... doesn't make a lot of sense. I actually, about a year and a half ago, Found my friend again, and he works up in Salt Lake. So I took him out for a beer, and we're sitting down, and I'm talking, and I'm saying, okay, now just for the, I explained that this experience is kind of fundamental, and it's still something that I'm grappling with, and in complete honesty, and I'm not going to get pissed off, even though I ran through that house so fast that there was no way he could have gotten from the front of the house all the way back into his sleeping bag by the time I was there, but still I'm thinking, was this a put-on? If it is, you got to tell me now, because this has metaphysical implications and in my own life and in my work, and I need to know what the hell happened. And so it was interesting that he, you know, and he just very, you know, years later, there's no reason for him to be continuing the BS. And he's like, no, I was as terrified as you were, and I had no idea what, you know, what was going on. And so this is something I'm grappling with, and it was interesting that that the feeling of this maliciousness was so real to me that that I actually felt bad about having run away. I felt bad about having left. You know, I felt like I should have stayed. I should have
let
stayed.
Let it play out.
I should have let. I should have. Where was this going to lead? You know, and if. And so I felt bad about that. And actually, as a missionary, I kind of sought out any experience. I thought if there was some opportunity to come in contact with a dark force, I wanted it, you know, because I didn't want to run away again. I just wanted to confront this, see it through. I felt bad about being so afraid, you know, being cowardly. I should have stuck it out. And it was interesting, though, that little follow-up on that was there was a sister in our mission field. I was the district leader in a mission field in a little town in Mexico, in Jalapa. And it was not a little town, but... and she became possessed of the devil. And so the mission president was, you know, a few hours away. So he just calls me on the phone. He's like, will you go cast the devil out of sister? I won't use her name because it doesn't matter. And I thought, okay, I guess so. I guess that's what I'm here for, so... I'm off, so I'm getting ready. And I'm starting to sweat it because it's like I say, I had a little experience with this, and I thought this is, maybe it's the showdown had finally happened. So, you know, I get there, my companion's with me. He's a native, and he's just sweating bullets because he doesn't want to go do battle with the adversary.
The adversary. Yeah.
And so I go in there, and I think I'm ready, and I walk in the door and go into the room. The other sister missionary is freaked out. You know, she doesn't know what's going on, leads me into the back room where the possessed sister is, and she's of course doing the whole exorcist thing with, you know, rolling her head around, making weird noises. And I entered the room, and I actually, they left, you know, the other two got the hell out of there because they didn't want to be any part of it. So I'm left alone to cast Satan out. and there was nothing there, you know. It's like I knew
what the feeling
I
was
knew what
and
the
it
feeling
wasn't,
would
yeah.
be, and it was completely absent. And it was just this woman acting weird in this room. There was no feeling of any like dark presence. There was no dark energy. There was no malicious. There was nothing, you know. And so I just sat down next to her and I said, "Okay, I've had a little experience with this, and you're not possessed. And I don't know what you're doing, but you're not possessed of the devil. And maybe you have emotional problems or psychological problems, but there's not, you know, there's no evil spirit here. So I'm not going to cast anything out." I said, "I'll give you a blessing, because obviously you've got some issues and problems, but there's no." And she immediately, as soon as I said, "You know, there's no, Satan's not here. There's no evil spirits. It's just you and me." As soon as I said that, suddenly she stopped making all the weird noises and the gyrations, and then gave her the blessing, and she thanked me, and I left. And then, interesting, she wasn't possessed again until I was transferred away, and then suddenly she became possessed of the devil again. But yeah, that was an interesting experience, and that is a counter, or at least an addition to that story, where that original experience was at least genuine enough, even though I still can't explain it. It was genuine enough that I didn't fall for the bogus, you know, I'm being possessed kind of business. But it is my tendency now, and I've got some of my story ideas have to do with possession and in a more philosophical way than just, you know, creepy, freaky stuff. But it is something that fascinates me and something that I recognize I have a tendency to. You know, again, I think it goes back to that experience of running away, and thinking next time I'm not, you know, if something like that ever happens again, I'm not running away. So, So anyway, so that's that story, and that's one of those. So when I speak about these experiences that were kind of formative, were very important, that's one of them. And the Carthage experience is one of them. Some of the really beautiful experiences I've had, mostly giving blessings to people, or feeling just moved, a spiritual confirmation or feeling of some spiritual presence or approval or something. Mm-hmm. Largely in a sense of community, as I've examined them later.
So in terms of your story then as well as now, you would say that you're still open to the fact that there's an unseen world that maybe has malicious characters in it, maybe doesn't. Are you just agnostic? I guess I'm just trying to get a sense for your...
As I've been answering your questions and talking about things, I think right up until this point, most people will be listening thinking... He sounds pretty Mormon to me, except for the, you know.
Going and having a beer with your buddy.
Pepper and propane and having a beer with my buddy. But it's tricky. First of all, I think one of the things that I learned was a real humility about my beliefs because I was so certain I was right. I think we need to jump ahead and go and then come back to this.
Okay, all right.
Basically, I think the important things to know as I continue this narrative is that I was I was a true believer. I mean, just completely, especially, and then afterwards, and by the time we get to the period of God's army, I was willing, ready, and desirous to do whatever I felt the Lord wanted me to do, and I felt that would be within Mormonism. I felt like I was convinced that Mormonism was true. I was totally on board with the whole restoration of the gospel and all this kind of stuff. And as that, I was very studious. I'd always been studious, but very studious. And I didn't want to know just the Deseret Book stuff, but I wanted to know what the anti-Mormons were saying so that when I would confront them outside of the Arizona temple when they're going crazy, that I could actually, you know, hold an intelligent debate, I guess you'd say. I wanted to know the answers. I wanted to know the problems. I wanted to know everything, you know, history, doctrine, everything. I loved Mormonism, everything about it, and was very committed. And by this time in my life, I'd even gotten to the point where my career was so completely entwined with my professional life, was so completely intertwined with Mormonism that it was basically complete, and I was completely absorbed. And so it was at this period, really gets to me is there's this perception and this belief. In fact, shortly after I lost my belief, I attended a sacrament meeting where this guy got up and said, he pulled a quote from, I can't remember which prophet said it, but somebody said, you know, that the only reason you lose a testimony is because of sin. So somebody's lost their
DNC testimony. 84, somewhere in the 50s. That's okay, basically
cool.
A scripture.
Yeah. Cool. And I was just livid by this because I was experiencing it. I was dealing with the ramifications of it. And I went back. It was like a state high counselor. And so I went up to one of the bishopric members and I was like, "Are you going to like counter this? Or is this?" He's like, "No. What's the counter? You know, you lose a testimony because you sin." And I was just like, "Ah, you guys don't know anything." But basically, what had happened was, Well, basically, what it is an answer to a prayer, which was I had just gotten to the point where I was feeling like I knew enough about about the church history and the church doctrines and stuff, and I got to a point where I was seeing a real discrepancy between, and I felt like one of the church's best apologists because I could come up with an answer for anything, you know. I mean, there wasn't a problem in the church there were just a couple that I really didn't have an intelligent response for, but I could come up with an answer for anything. Even I got to the blacks in the priesthood, that was an easy one.
Well, and you were putting it in the Elder Dalton character in God's Army. Responding to the multiple accounts of the first vision.
Yeah, very much so.
All those different things.
Felt like I could handle pretty much anything, and I did get to the point where there are things that even I struggled with, but like the Orson Hyde situation when he goes off to the, to dedicate the Holy Land, and while he's gone, Joseph hooks up with his wife.
Attempts to.
Yeah. And so I was, that was one that it took me a few days, even as the master apologist, but I came up with a great response. It's like, oh, okay, I can make peace with this. Okay, great, I see it. Now I see it differently. And just for the record, I thought it just made perfect sense because to Joseph, any authority other than priesthood authority was imaginary. It didn't exist. So just like a baptism that was done by someone without priesthood authority didn't have any validity, a marriage that was not performed by the priesthood had no validity either. It was just a couple people living together and thinking they were married. And so unless it was a sealing by the priesthood, they weren't really married. So it was a great little answer. And it actually, I was pretty proud of myself for coming up with that one because I hadn't heard anybody else do that. But anyway, so the point being, I was into everything, and there were things that it was like this enormous, a way to describe it, and this is difficult because I really have spoken about it so little, so I apologize if I'm not being really clear, but it was just like, it was like this big construct or a big structure in my mind where, there's this big edifice that was being built, and, some pieces of the edifice weren't quite finished yet, but it was all holding together pretty well, and there were problems. There were some serious problems, but the whole thing was still generally pulling together pretty well. But I got to the point where it was like, okay, but I get to this point where it's like, do I align myself more with the teachings of original Mormonism, or do I align myself more with the church as it is today? And despite what people will say, anybody who knows anything about church history and doctrine will know that the church of 2010 is dramatically different than the church of 1843. I mean, dramatically different. They're mm-hmm. almost unrecognizable.
And in between, lots of different Mormonisms.
Right. And so, but you get to that certain point, and my commitment was really to Joseph Smith, the Joseph Smith Brigham Young era, the whole restoration idea, and I was seeing these things that I didn't understand were, how does the restoration of all, it was becoming quite the opposite of the restoration of all things. It's like, as soon as Brigham Young died, it was almost like, let's get rid of this stuff as fast as we can. so it was the opposite of restoration. And yet, maybe there was some divine purpose in that, and so I was willing to go with that, and the whole deal. But it was the point where I was praying to get serious answers, and I was praying in the way that, in every way that we're taught to pray. Serious temple goer, true order of prayer, regular order, the pedestrian order of prayer, I don't know what you call it, the untrue order of prayer, but I was praying in every way possible to get answers, and the answer was, what do you want me to do? Where do you want me to go? Because I will go anywhere. I'll do anything. I mean, honestly, to the point where if I had received an answer that I was to be a fundamentalist and that the Lord wanted me to take another couple of wives and knowing that that would destroy my marriage or whatever, it was like, I want to do what God wanted me to do, whatever that was. That's the point that I was at for a long period of time. And I was living as close to the church, I guess you'd say the ideal, the Mormon ideal, as you could. And I was trying to, be as good, honest, moral in every way. I was living as upright a life as I think you could say, even including my missionary days. I was right down the line. I guess I was seeing some R-rated movies, so that was the whole problem.
Little secret sin.
It wasn't secret. I was perfectly willing to announce that to anybody. But point being, so I'm in this phase and I'm praying, and then it was the oddest and most unexpected thing, truly unexpected, it was after prayer and after some study, scripture study, and I was sitting in my room, in my bedroom. I was sitting in bed and just pondering things, thinking about everything, and for whatever reason, I just asked myself. It was like I think it was the first time I sincerely had asked myself this question since I was 14 years old. But I, you know, trying to make sense of everything and not getting an answer, being used to answers taking a long time, but still not getting an answer. And finally, I just asked myself, well, what if it's not true? What if it's not true? And I meant, in my mind, it was just like, and it was a sincere question. I was open to whatever the answer would be. And I was just like, well, what if it's all not true? And by that, I meant everything. You know, the Joseph Smith story, the restoration, and opening myself up to that question, and there was and the most unprecedented thing happened for me, which was I'd always heard people talk in church about hearing a voice, and I didn't understand what that meant. You know, they always like a, they it was as if I could it was actual voice, you know, speaking to me. And I didn't have anything like that. In fact, if anything, I was at this moment, I was expecting, because of my Mormon instruction, to be getting something from outside. You know, you get the voice from outside. You get an angel. You get something that comes from outside. But for me, what happened was I heard a voice, but it was my own voice, and I had never heard it before. And it was certainly not this clear, but it was from the very deepest part of me, the most pure, the most fundamental part of me, was the answer that said, "Of course, it's not true." It was just, and I just instantly recognized that this was not something from outside. This was me that I'd never really. It's hard to describe, but it's like something that I'd never really heard so clearly. But it was like a voice, but it was my voice. And it was, of course, it's not true. And as soon as I really heard that, it was instantaneous. You know, it was just like suddenly this entire construct that I had in my mind just instantly started to, and it just came down. And I instantly understood that all the problems that I was having, that this one answer answered every problem, everything that didn't make sense, every problem, it was the answer. You know, it was like, of course it's not true, and of course I knew that, and I don't know how long I had known that and been carrying it around, but in the deepest part of me, I knew that. So it was absolutely instantly the most terrifying and awful moment of my life. It was. I went from literally from 10 seconds before being a true believer to that moment knowing that I knew absolutely nothing, and that everything I believed and knew about the universe, about my life, my existence, everything, the world, everything was gone, and I knew nothing. I knew absolutely nothing. And I describe it to the few people that I've spoken with it about, I've described it as, I think maybe I'm just a visual, very visual, but it really felt, you know, the movies, you know, science fiction movies where they're in space and two ships disengage and one of them just starts to drift away. The natural force is pulling it away and they're never going to come back to you. And that's what I felt like something was, like a piece of me was leaving, and that I was, that it would never, it would only get farther away now. I would never get it back. And that was my belief, or my faith, I guess people would say. But more, I think my belief, because I still retain faith, but not a belief in Mormonism. And that's basically what happened. And it's such an internal thing, but such a powerful thing. But it's very hard to describe what happened. But I just knew, just like people would say. And the way I would describe it is just how Joseph Smith came in from the woods. Told his mother, "I've learned for myself that Presbyterianism is not true." I learned for myself at that moment that Mormonism is not true. And as I say that, I want to clarify that I'm not making some universal pronouncement or statement. This is the way that I believe, and as I continue to talk about this, I don't want people to... It's my point of view. And I could be wrong, because... That's one thing I learned, was a real humility about my beliefs, because I believe so firmly, and now I believe so firmly that no, it's not true. But anyway, the trying to communicate the kind of the terror that you feel after that moment. Most people that I've spoken to that have lost their belief have lost it like piece by piece, little bit, or they never really believed, but and then eventually they just leave. But to me, it was just like a breaking point, and it was absolutely terrifying. I mean, it really was, because I had no idea what it meant. How, what am I supposed to do now? And at the point, I think I was in my late 30s, so 39, I think. And so, you know, to be 39 years old and suddenly realize that you don't know anything about the universe and about you, about yourself, and everything that you've done before has been based on, you know, what I then understood to be a fantasy. Again, for myself, I understood it to be a fantasy. that meant that, how am I going to raise my kids? How am I going to, what am I going to do now? I'm a Mormon filmmaker and I don't believe in Mormonism anymore. And
so where is this in the lineup of your films?
I was trying to pinpoint the exact date. It was sometime in like September. I believe it was like September of 2003, because it was shortly before getting the financing to make States of Grace. And so I actually was so grateful for, because I was literally like a zombie after that for a little while. I was like, what? I mean, what do I do? Just putting one foot in front of another, it was like, what's the point? Where am I going? What do I do? And it was so, I was so grateful to get, be able to make that film, because it gave me something to do, you know, something physically to do. And I still, you know, so I, as I went into making States of Grace, there was so much work to do that it really kept me occupied. So as I was trying to process this, what had happened and what I was going to do about it, and I still knew that, you know, it's like, okay, I'm still good with Jesus, and I'm still good with God, and I still, you know, Mormonism has been such a positive experience for me, so I felt okay about making the film, and I felt better about making Falling, because it was just, I was in such a, I mean, there was such a feeling of despair and depression and impending tragedy that I felt more at home making that, I think, than the other. But that's where it fell in line, and that's where I went from. And from that time until now, it's been a gradual, not my level of belief has not changed, but it's been trying to manage that and trying to understand what I do believe, what I do think is real, what I do value, and what's good, and what do I do with these experiences that I had.
It happened within a Mormon context, basically.
Exactly.
But yet you still don't want to deny that they happened.
Exactly. I can't deny that they happened. Won't deny that they happened. And the thing for me is very important that reality is a huge thing for me. It's like, I know some people have a really flexible view on reality, and, you know, the reality is what you make it. And I tend more towards a, you know, there are certain things that are true and that are real. And yeah, there's some flexibility in that and whatever. But you know, I'm pretty practical when it comes to, you know, if you run out in the front of a bus, you're going to get killed by the bus, you know, and the bus is real, that kind of thing. So to me, and there were things, I mean, tons of questions, you know, and the psychology after having been in Mormonism for basically 30 years, a little over 30 years by that point, was there are things in your brain you don't even know they're there, you know, but I mean, I was so confused by what to do afterwards. It was like I knew that it wasn't true, and I knew that I would always know that it's not true. And it's hard to describe, but it's just, I just knew it.
Difference between true and good? I mean, you were able to still say it's good?
No, that's the question. Is it good? If it's not true, is it good? No matter what good it does, is it good? It's all these questions that were rolling around. Did I, you know, at first it was like my, I've lost my, in fact, one of the hardest parts about making Falling was because everything else was, you know, everything, I was so spent on every level. But there's a scene in that film when my character, it's after a lot of awful stuff has happened, and he parks his car and he puts a gun in his mouth and he is attempting suicide. And as an actor, I didn't want to go too much into this scene before. I just wanted to shoot it, you know, just do the scene and see what happened. And I didn't go into too much about what I would be thinking, what the character would be thinking, or what I as me, Richard, would be thinking in order to generate that kind of grief and despair. And so I kept putting it off until I had to do it. You know, I was pulling the car up and doing the scene, and right before I did it, I thought, all right, I know what I'm going to do, because I was so torn up about the fact that my son... Give me the gun, I'll do the scene. My son, Eli, was about to be baptized, or he was about to turn 8, so... And I knew that I couldn't baptize him. You know, I just knew that it wasn't a worthiness issue. It was, I didn't believe it. I couldn't do it. There's no way I was going to pretend to believe and do this. And so I knew that I'd have to sit down with him and say, and try to explain to him why he's the first son that doesn't get baptized by his father. And just tore me up so much that it was like, easy, put the gun in my mouth, love to kill myself. Not have to deal with this, you know, this kind of pain. So it worked great for the scene. Fortunately, by the time I actually had to have the conversation, I was much more at peace with it than I was then. But that's the kind of thing that psychologically I was going through. You know, it's the same thing. It's like this, you know, you're going to lose your family forever. And then it's like, I don't even believe this anymore. Why is this torturing my mind that I might be, you know, that I'm going to lose my family forever. I'm going to be the link that, you know, generate. And it's like, I don't even believe this anymore, but the talons are still in your brain, you know, and you can't get them out. It's the craziest thing. So it was the hardest thing. It's like, are my son's going to serve missions? And even though my mission was like this amazing and wonderful experience, I want my sons to do this? No, I don't. It goes on for a very long time afterwards. Anybody that's been through this experience, I think, can relate. I think that's there were so many things in this period. People thinking that it was an easy thing to do, and when I did, the people that were close to me that knew that I was leaving the church, you know, those kind of accusations where you're taking the easy way out. It's like, you have no idea.
I have to now put the whole universe back together,
right?
And you think that's easy? Forget
it.
I have
to keep my sanity, and I have to raise a family. I have to make a living, and most of all, I have to be. I can't ignore this. I can't pretend that it didn't happen. I can't. That's not the way that my brain works, you know. And so yeah, it's been a real difficult experience. But fundamentally, that's what happened for me. It's like I just instantly somehow knew that it wasn't true, and so I've had to kind of deal with that since then. And that's colored my work. It's colored, it's colored everything. You know, it's been a big game changer. Everybody's interested about how that has worked with my family. Everybody that speaks to me is like instantly, well, you know, how is it with, if they know Gwen, you know, it's like, well, how's Gwen dealing with it? And how's your wife, if they don't know her, how's your wife dealing with it? Everybody's very interested because it's interesting. But that was difficult too because... I didn't tell her immediately. It was a process of, okay, first of all, being able to talk about it, just trying to process what had happened to some degree, and then finally getting to the point where I did start to talk about it. And it wasn't easy. It was, we'd always had a really close relationship, but this was probably the closest we ever came to having real arguments was this was going to disrupt everything. And she, to her eternal credit, you know, she always was, I could tell that even when it was difficult, she was trying to be supportive, trying to be empathetic, understand what I was going through. But she was resistant because it was very clear where this was going to go, you know. And I can't, from the other horror stories I've heard about how other marriages have gone, mine was great, you know, it was not easy, but she was supportive and she wanted to continue to go to church, but you know, she continued to love me and, you know, be affectionate and supportive in every way that she possibly could. So it was really ideal. But I do remember the one kind of discussion when things got really into the thick of it and I really felt like she might not find peace with this. And that might become a problem, like a real problem in our marriage. There was one point when we were talking, and I remember saying something, which I was glad I said it because it really expressed it well, but it was like, you know, maybe you love, you know, this guy that lived 170 years ago more than you love me, referring to Joseph Smith. And I think that really, really stuck. And that was probably one of the last difficult conversations we had about it was, I don't know if that was as memorable to her as it was to me, but it was very much, it was like, yeah, are you going to, you know, are you really going to choose some guy that, you know, died 160 years ago instead of your own husband who's here?
Or,
right now?
And that translates a lot of times in the gay and lesbian same-sex thing is, are you going to choose, we have a relationship, but you're going to choose a story, an overarching narrative, a right. theory over this concrete relationship right. that we have. Yeah, it's a very powerful...
choose an institution over,
yeah.
over me. But no, she didn't. And to get caught up on the story, when I wrote the exit manifesto in 2007, she was still active in the church, and I was still supportive of that. Although at that time, I was getting to the point where I no longer wanted my kids going to church because I was starting to realize, like, I don't want them to have to go through what I'm going through now. Sooner get out, the better was my...
What would you have replaced it with? Had you put enough of the world together that you really felt like I can help them feel oriented within the universe
yeah,
without
the gospel? Yeah, well, that was a long process happening. But now they're, you know, they're not attending anymore.
No, nobody in the
nobody.
Family?
No.
Gwen included?
No, my youngest, who's going to turn 8 in a little bit, came to me this morning and was wanting to be baptized because everybody in the neighborhood is getting baptized. And so I told him, well, you know, we'll talk about this, but how do you feel about getting baptized in a river? Do you want to get baptized in a river, in a lake? You know, wouldn't that be a lot more fun? So maybe I'll just go out and baptize him. so he'll have the experience and have the family there for the support. But
that he's committing his life to good values and stuff rather than a specific
right,
membership
right.
within.
Right. Well, this was really difficult for me because, again, I'd had a good experience. So complex. You know, it's like I say, it's so intertwined. It's so mixed. One thing that really creeped me out was as I was trying to figure out, do I want my kids there? Do I not? And I was letting them go, and I would pick them up at church sometimes. I didn't go unless, you know, somebody was doing something. I tried to avoid it because I just didn't want to be there anymore. But one time going to pick up the kids and walking past the primary room and hearing all the, you know, hearing 60 kids in there all singing, follow the prophet, follow the prophet. And it just seriously creeped me out. It just really made me feel like I was just walking past the brainwashing room. and that really changed. And then I started to see, and then, you know, everything, this all the repetitiveness in it, and all the, there's so much baggage that goes along with it that, yeah, you have a great community and you hear some good things, you know, being nice to people and all the basic teachings of Jesus, which, you know, I am totally on board with. But it comes along with so much baggage, so much guilt over unnecessary things, so much fantasy, so much believing in things that aren't true, that I made the decision that I really wanted to kind of encourage my children out of it eventually. I mean, at first I wanted them there because they, of course, they had to be there. But then later I got to the point where it was like I wanted to kind of encourage them out. And I got to the point where my oldest son, who's 19 now, pulled him aside a few months ago and just said, so just want to make, and he's not active in the church, but I just said, so how are you feeling? Is a mission at all on your radar? Are you thinking about that? And he said, oh no. I was like, oh good, thank you. which is interesting, and it may seem weird to some people because I had such a good mission myself, but that was me, and he's him, and his life's going to be different, and I really those torturous days after my loss of belief, when I thought that I was going to be damaging my children eternally, has led to a belief that I'm doing the best thing that I can for my kids because I want them to embrace all truth, all goodness. I want them to be good people. But one of the great realizations that I had, and there's so many things you don't even understand about your own mind when you're in the middle of it, but it wasn't until I got out of it and started just seeing looking at humanity in general, and I was very distrustful, of course, of any other religion. So I was still interested in obviously anything, but
and I knew
I was
you'd
distrustful.
Read the Krishnamurti and you know any institutional stuff is going to be a cloud, you know.
Yeah, Krishnamurti was very influential.
Yeah, why carry the boat that helped me get across the river around with me?
Right.
You know, and if I've made it over there,
right.
Yeah, the goal.
Krishnamurti was fantastic. Actually, that was a book that I just found randomly in Santa Monica when I was shooting States of Grace, and I wanted something spiritual, and I just never heard of the guy and picked it up and started reading it, and it really, really resonated with me. So that was really influential.
Think on These Things, is that the one?
Yeah, Think on These Things, Krishnamurti. And then later, actually, then reading William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, was also helped me make sense of some things of how I was interpreting experiences according to how I'd been programmed to interpret them. That was really enlightening and good. But, yeah, I guess that's the only thing. I don't know how well I've communicated that, but that period of... It's still a difficult time. I miss the certainty, you know. I miss the feeling that I'm right. I miss the security of knowing what's going on in the universe, because right now you ask where I am now and do I believe in God? Yes, I do. But that's as far as I'll go with it. If somebody said, what's he like? I have no idea. I don't even know if it's he, you know. I feel like I've made contact with God in my life several times, but I don't presume to even begin to expound on what he is. And I'll use the term he because.
But you would believe that God's personal, or you would say, I don't even know if it's a personal, being or a.
Yeah. I wouldn't.
But somehow there's some expansiveness to the universe that you've touched. You can't deny that you've touched it. And if that would be maybe what you'd call God, or at least that's the minimal.
Right. You know. I mean, I know there's something there, and I'll continue to. I've gone back to. In fact, I tried to engage you and some other friends in a conversation one time where I was trying to take us back to the what is basic. What is, if we just start from the very basics to try to understand what God is, and I was proposing this whole idea that. The only way to, I mean, what do we, how do we start to try to find God is, to me, it was like looking at the expressions of God or of creation. So to me, it was life, it was, you know, nature, human beings and dogs and camels and everything, trees, mosquitoes, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it's taking life and then it's like, if I was trying to understand a creator, an artist, I would look at what he had created and that might give us clues to who or what or how he is. So that was kind of my approach at the time, was like, you know, trying to just look at reality, look at life, not just life, but, you know, death and the decay. It's all a part of God, if there is a God. So all of that was kind of, and I guess to a certain extent, it's still where I am now, because I do believe in life and goodness. I had one experience that's worth noting that helped me understand some of what some of my own spiritual experiences, and it was unexpected. This was after Falling, maybe a year or so after I'd shot Falling, so it had been a little while, and I hadn't had a lot of spiritual experiences because after this crash, it was mostly just despair, So I had another unexpected experience where my wife and I had gone to Washington, D.C. just to get away to have a nice time. So we were hitting the museums and stuff. And we thought, oh, let's go hit the Lincoln Memorial because why not? It's Lincoln Memorial. You got to see it.
It's the coolest place there.
So we went to the Lincoln Memorial and we walk in. And I'm there and I'm looking around. And, you know, you got your little bus tours walking around. And I'm looking at this huge statue and it's beautiful. It's just incredibly well done, powerful and big. And I'm looking at that, and I'm looking up at the walls, and they've got, I think it's the Gettysburg Address that's etched into the walls.
And then the second inaugural is on the other wall, right.
And I'm reading these words, and I'm there, and there's something about this whole thing, and the ideas that he's talking about, the ideals that he's talking about. And I just have this experience that's very much what I would call a spiritual experience. I felt this contact with something other, something higher, something beautiful, something completely good, and moved, you know, emotionally, because that's kind of my reaction when I make that connection. There's something that's just, that kind of melts me because it's so beautiful. And so I instantly go, wait a minute, I am having a spiritual experience. And what is this? But it was interesting because I walked away it was a wonderful experience and I was grateful for it. But I walked away, I think, a little wiser than I was when I had previously had spiritual experiences, because I didn't walk away going, this experience means that God approves of America and
everything that America does
right.
in the free world is
right. And therefore George W. Bush is a true president. Nothing like that. It was walked. In fact, it made me think, and I started to process that, and I started to realize that what that experience was me kind of reaching out to these beautiful ideals and beautiful ideas and these very noble things that, and so my spirit kind of reaching out for that and somehow making some kind of contact with the beauty of those and the power and the goodness of those ideas. And so I went back and I started looking at my experiences in Mormonism, and I was like, oh yeah, that's what that was again. It was within a Mormon context, but I was still reaching, I mean, it was still the ideas of community or the ideas of love. You know, I put my hands on a woman's head and just very loving, I mean, open myself up and just with all the love that I could possibly have, try to help this person. Naturally, you know, you're going to have a great experience because it's an experience of love. And then I started to put all this stuff together and realize that all of these things, even that experience in Carthage Jail where I was, again, I was opening myself up to, you know, the ideals of, you know, the bravery and the courage of this prophet and him, you know, willing to give his life and all this, these very noble things. I was being moved by that. And then as I stepped back, I started to realize that a lot of these things that I had always assumed to be in the domain of the religions, because they claim them, you know, the institutionalized religions claim virtue as if it's theirs. Morality is theirs. Chastity is theirs. Sobriety, everything, anything that's good, they somehow pull it under their tent, you know, as if it originated there.
Right.
And I started to realize that all these virtues were human virtues, that the religions had co-opted them, but that they were really human virtues. Goodness is a human virtue, you know.
So you don't put that virtue into the fabric of the universe somehow. It's enough for you at this point to say it's a human virtue.
Ooh, well, that's a good question. I don't know. Goodness of the fabric of the universe. That's a great question that we should talk about sometime, because I see a lot of darkness and maliciousness, or at least mindless malice in the universe.
Okay. I don't know. Overarching arc of the universe luring.
No, I don't know about that. This is one of the things about God that concerns me, and I was always somewhat aware of, and it really hit me after the tsunami when that was big news and everybody was sending money and everybody was praying and concerned. There was one experience in particular that stuck out for me, because I was in a church and they were talking about a toddler, like a 2-year-old or something, that had been found floating on a door, and so the toddler had been saved, and talking about how God had saved this toddler. And I remember at the time just being like, are you kidding me? It's like, why don't we start talking about the hundreds of toddlers that not only in a tsunami but in all the African genocides, and it's like, let's start talking about that, because that's just as much an expression of God as the little toddler who's found there. And so that's definitely something that I take into consideration when I'm thinking about God. It's like, for every saved person, there's a lot of tragedy and ugliness, and that's got to be taken into account. You know, that's part of God, if anything is. So yeah, do I believe in God? Yes. And I don't know anything about him. I love goodness, and I mean, those things are still so much something I strive for, and those experiences are still, I'm still reaching for the good things. I recognize that I've become a little more cynical, very much more skeptical. I'm open. Yeah, that's the best way to describe my where I'm at right now is I'm very open, but I'm very skeptical, even about my own experience. This crazy experience with malicious forces when I was 16, where it's like I'm open to the fact that that was a genuine experience and that there are malicious forces that wanted to destroy me at that point. But I'm also very aware that it's very possible that something very real happened and I, you know, interpreted it in this way, or that I was a teenager, I was a crazy teenager, who knows what energies are flowing around, maybe. Yeah, so I don't know, but yeah, I'm open, I'm still searching, but I'm doing it with a real caution.
Yeah, because so you're still seeking spiritual experience or this wider connection or, you know,
right.
Truth and ideals. Any spiritual practices that you've kept up, prayer, meditation, deep contemplation, nature walk? I mean, what is it that you're, I love the line, for those Mormon Stories listeners, maybe Tom Kimball and I did a three-parter on Stages of Faith, and one of the really favorite lines for me is the founder of Stages of Faith, James Fowler. Tom asked him a question one day when he came to Sunstone, and Tom says, you know, everybody's having these spiritual experiences and I'm not having them. And he goes, well, what are you doing to put yourself in a position where you'd have those? In other words, you can't get hit by a train unless you put yourself near the railroad tracks. And so I'm saying, you know, I know listeners, those of you, Richard and I hang out at least once a month, you know, probably for the last 5-6 years. I know you're actively pursuing a spiritual path, mm-hmm. even though it's not necessarily a Mormon path. But what practices have you found to be the most helpful? And
awareness, I think, is probably the biggest. I honestly think every day for me is kind of a spiritual experiment, or at least an observation. I'm trying to process everything, and still, this is fundamentally what is fundamentally most important to me is figuring it out, and not in the sense that I'm going to figure it out, because I don't have that kind of an ego to think that I'm going to figure this out. It's like I'm the created cannot understand the creator. Mm-hmm. That'd kind of be my point of view, but I think it's my job to try to live the most genuine and authentic life I can. It's to try to align myself with realities, whether they're universal realities, spiritual realities, all realities, is very important. And so, yes, I pray, not as often as I think a religious person would expect one to pray, but I think I approach life in somewhat of a very prayerful, reverent way, hopefully open-eyed, clear-eyed kind of way. Fasting every now and again, I'll do that because I kind of, you know, but that's more of a religious extremity or an extreme religious practice. That's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, generally, I'd just say an awareness and an openness, seeking, ready. I'd jump down, you know, if I see a clue somewhere, I'm instantly after it because it's a preoccupation, to say the least.
It matters. These types of things matter to you.
And also, filmmaking for me and writing, it's a way for me to continue, and it's still that way for me. I mean, it's still very much I'll chase after stories or elements of stories that I don't understand, that I have questions about, that I want to explore. And so this film now that I'm doing, this triptych film, is very much one of these kind of films that's helping me to explore some things, some spiritual concerns and some questions that I don't have answers to, and so that's very helpful, and that's why it's very important for me to maybe that's the filmmaking is a
spiritual discipline practice. Absolutely. Good. So you've already mentioned that you miss the certainty, but overall, you're happier than you were.
I don't know, you're happier
today than you were in 2000 when God's Army was released and it was purely open-hearted, sincere movie.
No, I'm not happier. I think in a I think I was happier in the certainty. I mean, who wouldn't be happier when you know that you're going to live, you know, you're going to live forever, you know, that you're going to be creating worlds, you know, that you'll have your children with you forever, your wife with you forever.
Great story. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you go to a point where you, now you know that what you have now may be it. And so it makes life so much more precious. I mean, it certainly does. You realize that if you're going to have relationships with your kids or your family, you do it now because that's most likely it, you know. And but no, not happier. But I'd rather be here because now I'm living in reality as I perceive it, and it's a painful reality at times. I mean, that kind of pain doesn't go away. That kind of loss. I miss the community. You know, I miss the beauty of some of the doctrines that I no longer believe. I miss the people. I miss going to the temple. I loved going to the temple. I miss, you know, so much of it. But for me, as soon as I realized that it wasn't true, I couldn't stay. You know, I've had people ask me, in fact, one of our mutual friends one night, when I think I was complaining about the fact how difficult it is for me now to try to raise money because so many people are prejudiced against me because they know that I've left the church. And then our friend said, well, you did that to yourself. And I'm still irritated about that, you know. It's like, well, hold on, back up. Was I supposed to pretend to believe in order to raise money? In which case, what the hell is that? What kind of a person would I be? What kind of integrity would I have in order to do that? In fact, that's when
those questions were on the ones posed for me to ask you today. Have you ever been tempted since this happened to stick around and pretend? Yeah.
Oh, Lord, I cannot imagine. One of the reasons I eventually had to go public with my own beliefs was just that. I could not live with... I would have people stopping me in the grocery store telling me about their sons who were going on missions and how much my work had inspired them and telling me all these other spiritual experiences, very open. And I was at a very different point. They were making assumptions which were understandable.
I'm talking to Elder Dalton here, man.
Exactly. And I was, you know, in a different place, and I would find myself at restaurants and I'd want a glass of wine, so I'd order a glass of wine, but then I'd notice that somebody was over there looking at me funny because they knew who I was, and here I was drinking wine, and they thought, you know, and instantly it was like, okay, I'm not a hypocrite and I don't want to be perceived as such, and so I needed to come out and just tell everybody where I was. And also I felt I owed it to the community, you know. It was part of that openness. I'd always been open with my work, and I was also open in other ways, but it's, especially when you live in a community where you work, it was important for me to at least, you know, respect that relationship enough to say, okay, this is where I am, this is what I believe. But to have stayed, you know, for people to think that I would, you know, pretend to believe or keep going to church so that I could raise money, so that I could provide for my family, I'd rather not, you know. To me, even the question to me gets me going because it's like, how could I do that? You know, how could I have any integrity and do that? And that's been one of the hardest things. Is one of the hard things about having the experience that I had was realizing that I was going to potentially lose everything. I could lose my family. I would certainly lose, or at least my career would have to be drastically reorganized. I would lose the respect and affection of a lot of people. And basically, it was a bunch of loss, and it was all, it all hinged on
that voice inside.
Yeah. Yeah, and being true to truth. That was an ironic thing for me, was in Mormon, you know, Mormonism instilled in me such a focus on truth. You know, truth is paramount. Truth is everything. And that is Mormonism, you know, truth, and you accept the truth. Mm-hmm. And it never occurred to me that at some point I would have to choose between truth and Mormonism, but that day for me did come, and I chose truth. And everything else has been just a domino effect after that. But I'm still glad I made the decision because I really don't see what a viable alternative would have been. I see others who, I talk to a lot of people who don't believe, but they keep, because of family or whatever, they keep going through the motions, and that's not me. I understand why they're doing that, but that's not me. I couldn't do that. And of course, I'm speaking from a point of view where I don't have a lot of family that's LDS, so I lost, you know, a lot of friends. I lost a lot of business contacts.
But not the generations back.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and you know, I've made a different choice than you. We've talked about my journey too, in many ways very similar to yours. But I've managed to find reasons to stay that aren't simple in any way. And so,
right.
So I've always felt respected by you for those choices, and I hope you've always felt respected by me and certainly by this audience that are listening to you now.
There is one thing that I want that's important for me to cover, and I hope a few people are still listening now, because I've tried to make this very clear from the beginning. But when I left, even though I tried to be very clear without being too specific about things, there was instantly the perception that I had left because, well, of course, the same old reason, somebody offended me, but mostly people said I was angry because people weren't going to my movies, yeah. and so every opportunity I could get, I tried to clarify that this was not the case, but it still persists as being, you know, people, there's still this perception out there that I left Mormonism because people weren't going to my movies, and that is so incredibly offensive to me, because if I were that shallow of a human being that I would abandon my, you know, spiritual home because people weren't going to my movies, I would be an idiot. I'd be a fool, an imbecile, and it was so much not the case. And as I pointed out before, even though the films didn't do as well, still they did pretty well for an independent film, for independent films. Even States of Grace, which only made a couple $100,000 at the box office, for an independent film, that's still pretty good. And there was, you know, there was an appreciative audience. There were people that did go
good,
to the film.
Good critic, yeah. Reviews every time.
Reviews and a large audience that still loved the films. And so that was so much not in my mind. And did I want more people to see my films? Absolutely. Did that drive me out of the church? Absolutely not, you know. And so, yet that's what I still get. Most of all, it's like he left because he's angry because people didn't go see his movie. I was like, are you a moron? You know, because that is so not true.
So Richard, thanks for talking so much about your journey within Mormonism. One just point of clarification that a couple of people asked on the questions that they sent in ahead of time, and I think I know the answer to this, but it's just, have you written a letter to resign your membership in the church? Why or why not?
Well, it was interesting. As soon as I read, I checked up on the site to see what kind of questions were going to be coming, and I saw that, and it was interesting, and I thought, oh. And there was that moment of, did I write? And I was like, no, I didn't. I guess I didn't. But no, I haven't. And it was interesting. The first thought when I read the question was, oh, that's some unfinished business I got to take care of. But I don't know. It's interesting that people have asked me that several times, and it's interesting that that's important, and I don't understand exactly the clerical importance of that.
That would be a symbolic, truly cutting the tether, or
yeah,
something.
Maybe so.
It's a gesture that they feel compelled to make that maybe at least to this point you haven't.
Yeah, no, honestly, it's interesting that I kind of put it out of my mind, because a year ago that was something that was really pounding away in my head, and I was thinking, I need to do this, I should do this, it's time to do this. And then I didn't, and so maybe thanks for the reminder that maybe I need to take care of that. But again, it's kind of interesting that it does carry such importance, because, I mean, I've left the church emotionally. I've left the church publicly. And yes, there's some, you know, record in some clerk's office that counts me as a member of the church. So I guess I need to take care of some of the accounting, some of the paperwork.
You don't want to be in the active, and you don't want to tip the balance in how many active members. just use it.
So yeah, so the question takes me a little bit off guard because it seems very important to a lot of people, and maybe that should be important to me, and it has been in the past. So, terrible answer.
I think it's a very interesting and a very good answer. Yeah. Appreciate you being
but,
so
but
honest.
But if
it.
I do it, that's another thing. That's if I do feel that that's like something that's really important to do, and I can see why I think it could be important to do. It's probably going to be a very long letter, or maybe I'll just include, you know, a copy of this podcast and say, for my reasons, you know,
listen to the
this.
7 hours or however long we've gone.
But yeah, I think if I do leave, even if it's, if I do leave in that kind of formal of a way, then, and I think I probably should, because a lot of people are going to say, well, he's still got his records on the membership, so he's still a member, and it's just kind of confusing for people, so I probably will. But when I do, I want to make sure that letter again is something that acknowledges the beauty of my time in Mormonism and how much I still value it and how much I'm grateful for it. And it won't be an angry letter. It won't be the church has been awful and I'm leaving. It will not be anything like that. It would just be it's time for me to go, and thank you for... thanks for the
for
journey.
For serving me on this journey.
This journey, yeah.
Now I'm not going to drag you around with me as I keep moving forward.
Yeah. So stop sending the home teachers
around. Very good. Last question or two, just because it came up through the listeners who asked questions ahead of time. In any of this journey that you've been on, have you found or looked at the ex-Mormon, post-Mormon message boards, kind of the groups and the things that have been in there? Have you spent any experience with them? And if so, have they served you in a positive way, a negative way, et cetera?
Yeah, I spent a little time on the postmormon.org site and found that to be, for a time, that was very helpful. Like I say, there are different kind of cycles that, at least that I've gone through. I don't want to universalize my own experience, but cycles that I went through, and one of them that was good to be there for a while. I would for a few months there, I was pretty frequently checking in and kind of staying in some of the discussions and found some good support there. But what I found was that was a very temporary place for me, in the sense that, I mean, if you go back now, you're reading the same discussions and the same...
Yeah, it's because new people are coming to it.
Right.
That's the same thing I said at Sunstone all those years. It's the same topics over and over again, but yet it's a new audience that's...
Right, and it definitely serves a helpful purpose. I've always tended to stay away from the... again, I went through a period where I was angry. There were things I was angry about. I was angry because I felt, to a certain extent, that I'd been duped by whoever it was or whether it was just a mass, insanity that I'd bought into. But so there was a period there where I did feel angry, and I tried to the best of my ability to keep that private, because again, I didn't like. I still to this day cannot stand the anger in the anti-Mormon community and the post-Mormon community. When things get too angry, I just check out, because it's like, usually they're angry and they're not really speaking in a very informed way anyway. They're just venting.
Which is an important step, maybe, but yet it's not.
But I'm glad I never vented publicly anything. So I find them valuable. No, I don't hang around them anymore, but and I've avoided the ex-Mormon group. Frankly, I've been invited several times to go, but I have enough mutual friends who do go and have told me some of the crazy things that, people wandering around in temple clothes and that is so foreign to, I want nothing to do with that,
Even if you don't believe that it's sacred.
Yeah. Well,
anymore,
interestingly, I was with someone recently who was talking to me, a non-Mormon who was talking to me about about Mormonism and my leaving. And she asked me, about the temple, and I was saying, oh no, there's some really beautiful things. She goes, I heard they touch your privates. And I said, okay. And I said, no, they don't. And it's a really beautiful ceremony. It's called the initiatories, and they don't get anywhere near your privates. And then she wanted to know the secret, the secret handshakes and everything. I was like, you know what? If you want those, you can go to the internet and figure that out. But But I'm at the place now where I have such affection for the community, and I value my experience in it because I feel like it was very much an important part of my spiritual experience. But I don't participate in the anger. I always want to be considered a friend of Mormonism and of Mormons. And I don't think there's anything constructive to be gotten out of attacking it. And what other point was I trying to make before I got sidetracked on that story? But yeah, that's where I am. It's like I still have a lot of affection, but I don't... and I do have things that I'm still a little angry about, but I keep them to myself because out of respect for the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to loop back just for a second. I think I know the answers, but I want to ask them. They were asked in the list, and I think in your 2007 exit, you know, parting words to Mormon cinema, which was really about Mormon cinema and helping to grow, you did mention that you're hoping to not become a Thomas Marsh
right.
figure today. So I'd love you to tell what you meant there, if you don't mind, and have you felt like you've been treated the way Thomas Marsh was treated?
No, actually, that came out. That was in the follow-up because I did
the
thing
was in
the
Daily Herald. Right, that was actually in the one for Mormon Stories. You're right.
And then, so I did the thing, and I you know, I was asked to write for that editorial for the Daily Herald, and they wanted me to just do a Mormon cinema, and I kind of came back and said, well, actually, it's turning into more of this. Are you guys still interested? And it's like, yeah, we're interested. In fact, we'll give you the whole page. So that's what I gave them. And I tried, so, I mean, that was such a heartfelt, I wrote that in the office right next to us here in my office. And it was like breaking up. And I was wiping away tears, and I was trying to communicate very clearly, but very sincerely and very gently. And I wanted it to be a positive thing, and sent it out there. And just immediately, I mean, the anger and the vitriol just came at me in such force that it really did feel like I just opened up and was getting kicked, you know. And that's when the follow-up came, when people were already on the internet saying, oh, he's probably a homosexual, he's probably having an affair, he's a drug addict, he's whatever, you know, just nonsense. Or
in order to make it fit within this worldview that says it has to be something.
Yeah, he said something about beer, it's obviously
can't be genuine.
Alcohol. It's just the stupidity and then the anger. And that's when I came back and I'd been contemplating, and I'd watched that process over and over as people had left the church from the very beginning, and you know, the character assassination starts immediately. And that's when I just stepped up and said, okay, you know, this is probably going to happen to me, but I'm not going to go down without a fight, you know, and I'm going to at least point out what's happening while you're doing it. And
for our listeners who may not remember why Thomas Marsh was the example you chose.
Thomas Marsh was the example I chose because he was one of, you know, he's always brought up in Sunday school lessons as, you know, this is the apostle that threw away his exaltation
everything.
And everything because his wife was cheating another sister off of the strippings of the milk, and he was so offended that she would be called on the carpet for it, and so he left the church. And that's one of those stories that's such utter bullshit that when you look into it and realize that, no, he left during, you know, this is the Sidney Rigdon salt sermon days and Far West when things went crazy, you know, and the lives of these leaders were being threatened by other leaders, and they weren't happy with how things were going. And basically Thomas Marsh and Oliver Cowdery and a bunch of others just got out of town because their lives were in danger from the saints, from other leaders in the church.
Who weren't turning the other cheek and
right.
who were, yeah, they were retaliating.
It was complete insanity, and they were actually in danger of being killed. And so they got the hell out of town. And of course, that part of the story is never told. And
I've so always reduced very, as a full-blooded person with lots of reasons to this one soundbite, this morality tale.
And I thought, this is going to happen to me. I do not want this to happen to me. And again, you know, instantly I have all this complex story and the very painful story. But people want to believe that it's because somebody wasn't buying tickets to my movies. So I just came out with that to say, okay, I'm aware this is what happens, you know, and you know, especially that idea of, you know, it's interesting, when I left, a few people reached out to say, we love you, we want you back, what can we, you know, is there anything we can help you with? But most people didn't, you know. It was that thing of most people, the wandering sheep, they don't reach out to bring it home. They get up on the tower, pull out the high-powered rifle, and try to shoot your wandering brains out.
Just because it makes their story less complicated if you're gone.
Yeah, and there were things that I needed. You know, I had fallen away at a point where I was probably as worthy as somebody could be. There were interesting parts of my story that, of course, would be more interesting and it'd be easier to dismiss if I had just simply wanted to be a drug addict, gay drug addict. In fact, shortly after this, I ran into a guy, another guy, an artist who had left the church, just happened to run into him in an art museum in Springville. And he goes, I totally know what you're going through. He's like, everybody, you know, you leave the church and they instantly think that 2 years from now you're going to be found dead and naked in a gay whorehouse with a needle in your arm. You know? And it's like, that's exactly what, you know, people are reacting this way.
Has it happened? I mean, it happened immediately in the aftermath or overall? Are you still getting it?
You know, I have to actually be pretty grateful because I don't know if it was because of that initial stepping out and saying, acknowledging this, but also the way that I expressed myself. And afterwards, I tried so very hard, even though I was aware of just the nastiest things being said about me on the internet. And there's always that reaction to get on and defend yourself. And I tried so hard. I failed in a couple instances, you know, when I was... It's hard to describe how hurtful that is, you know, to when you open up to that kind of a degree and you have just this malice being just poured out at you. And all the speculation but for the most part, I was able to, you know, hold my ground, just let people say what they needed to say, and go on about their business. And whenever I would step in and try to defend myself, I'd always regret it. You know, it was like, that was foolish, that was stupid. Just let them say whatever they're going to say. So there's been a lot of generosity, but no, even now, it's been so long, and even all this time that I've made such pains to always very publicly be generous and not angry, and avoided there are so many opportunities whenever something would happen with Mormonism in the world, newspaper people would call me as like, will you comment on it? It's like, no, I don't want to comment on this. You know,
I don't want to be your opposing view.
Exactly. I'm not going to be your angry ex-Mormon. That's just not me. And so for the most part, but it still bugs me and it hurts me. It's like, you know, people from what I still consider in some ways to be my community, or at least my hometown where I grew up, that's a good way of putting it, who will get, you know, especially get on the internet or write to papers or whatever and just say the most stupid, hateful things that it gets to me, but I think that's the minority. And
it's certainly not just Mormonism. It would be a phenomenon in any other close-knit religious community with a strong theology of why people go wrong.
Yeah. One thing I found very interesting is since I went public, well, basically since anybody's known, I don't think there's been a single time, except for when my stake president came over to visit, who was a very good man, by the way, and very, very considerate. But nobody wants to know why I left, except people who have left. You know?
Very interesting.
Family members that are still attending, friends that are still attending. None of them want to know my story, you know. They don't even, in fact, even if we're at a dinner, some dinner party or something, and the conversation starts to lean towards things, and I start, you know, I know a lot about Mormon history and doctrine, so I'll start talking. And it's interesting how quickly I can clear out a table. because people really don't want to know, you know. And that's been a little disappointing. And yet I understand that at the same time. It's kind of threatening. It's not like I was just some guy that wandered into the church, was there for a year, and left.
They might have to wrestle with something in their own life if they heard too much from you.
If they open up a little too much and listen to the story, maybe it's a little too much. So.
Well, in that 2007 thing, you also mentioned the possibility of becoming an Oliver Cowdery someday. Is that And what I mean is returning to the church, the embracing it in some way again, at least more formally and publicly. Has that waned in the past 3 years since you at least left that tantalizing possibility out there?
Well, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? I think that's pretty much an impossibility, honestly. But yeah,
I mean, even if I keep talking to you for another 20 years, you're not coming my direction?
I don't see it happening. But to be quite honest with you, what I would love to, if I could organize the universe in a way, the way that I want it to be, I would love for, well, tomorrow, anytime, bring it on now, I would love to suddenly come to some understanding that would make everything make sense, including my very real experience of separation, and to come back knowing that it, understanding that it was all real, that it's all true, and that I was somehow wrong, or
that's an interesting
because again, like I say, I was happier then, but I don't think that's going to happen. But if I were just if I were to say a spiritual fantasy, yeah, I think that would be it. To be able to, I would love to come back, but I can't come back unless I really believe it, and I don't think that's going to happen. So.
And Joseph Smith, just to be clear, still a powerful character, an interesting, powerful person, someone that you're still wrestling with, or have you pretty much figured out who he is, and are you wanting to share?
I think that? I figured out pretty much figured out who he is, and I still am fascinated by him, you know, and still have a lot of admiration for him. And it's more complex than to just say, and I know when I do make the film, I know there's going to be a lot of questions.
Okay.
Is he a prophet? Is he not a prophet? What do you believe
right.
in?
Right. We want the five-second answer.
All the sound bites just aren't going
to
work.
And I don't want to ask you for a super easy answer, but right. I was just kind of thinking, you know, the universe lines itself up and it's all true or not. I'm just wondering if maybe that conduit to it, or at least that thing that still is a umbilical as all is the decision to keep wrestling with him and his life and the force.
Yeah, I don't think
the force of his ideas
anymore.
So much.
No, I'm not. I'm not so much wrestling. I'm still very interested. Actually, one point that I was trying to make earlier and I forgot about it because I got sidetracked. But when you know you're asking me where I am, it's interesting because I usually find myself being the defender of Mormonism because I find myself often in groups of non-Mormons or. And everybody has a you know something
we want
to
our team,
talk about,
and so, yeah.
and I find myself more often than not. I'm interesting because if I'm with a bunch of you know just true believing Mormons that want to talk about it but don't really know anything, then I find myself seeming to be the you know the bearer of unpleasant news. But I also find myself often in the situation of being with people who have axes to grind or they're, you know, wanting to bitch about the church or Joseph Smith or whatever. And I find myself being the one defending.
Polarizing.
It's opposite, like at least yeah. saying, okay, get your facts straight before you start, you know.
Yeah.
If you don't even understand the doctrine, then don't talk about it. And so I find myself, interestingly, being the guy that is drinking a beer and telling them that their anti-Mormonism is totally off base and ignorant, you know. So if they're going to be anti-Mormon, they should at least be informed.
Very interesting. You may not come back as a Mormon. You may not be Oliver Cowdery that says, I want to repent and rejoin the community. Is there a chance to get you called back, or is there a chance that you still might call back and change your mind about Mormon cinema? I know you think it's dead and all that stuff, but there was a real... So many of these questions that came in is, oh, Richard, I still want you to tell the stories that we need to have told in Mormonism. Everything from, you know, I want you to tell the story of, obviously, Joseph Smith. They want that told. We want you to, you know, teach the world who Sonia Johnson is and tell that story. We want Levi Peterson's backslider and the cowboy Jesus to do it. And you're our heroic filmmaker. You're our most talented shining light. And we want you to make those films. So you've talked about Mormon cinema be dead. Is there any chance that you ever might come back and decide to really tell Mormon stories again or make Mormonism a, a character in your films once
well,
more.
Well, yeah, Mormon cinema is dead, and I
as a movement,
think we've covered it. It's dead, and like okay. I say, it's not going to come back. There may be great Mormon filmmakers, but as far as Mormon cinema being some kind of cooperative movement, that's a nonsensical fantasy, and so no, that's not going to happen. As for me making more films that deal with Mormonism, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Joseph Smith, obviously. But
yeah,
then,
Joseph yeah. Smith. But there's more than that because there's so many powerful stories to tell.
Would your True Believer Western ever?
I don't think
make
I could
it?
Do that one again because that was so much tied up with you know, the restoration and it being a reality you know, in the universe. So I don't think I could do that again. No, I mean. No, there are things like I've got a list that I carry around with me. That's these film either things that I'm actively working on, scripts that I'm working on, or concepts that are somewhat developed.
That you're just yeah.
And yeah, Mormonism is a part of my. I mean, it's a part of me. It always will be. I mean, it was such a part of my spiritual evolution that that it's always going to, I think, influence my work. I'm always going to be responding to it in a certain way. But even more directly than that, yeah, there are stories I want to tell. The Hans Mill Massacre, love to tell it. The Mountain Meadows Massacre, that's mine, baby. I want that. You know, I want to make
oh,
that.
I thought you were the filmmaker that made September Dawn. there was somebody who I hope was joking when you wrote that in.
So. And so things like that, yeah, the Joseph Smith story. And there's more, you know, and I would love to tell these stories, and
okay,
a lot
good.
Of it's just, you know, financing, but no, I don't see that. In fact, there was one guy, a friend was recently listening to, she was telling me that she'd mentioned that she knew me, and this guy was ranting about the fact that, you know, I left the church and I still want to make, you know, he shouldn't make films about Mormons if he's not Mormon anymore. I find that really weird. You know, it's like I'm supposed to, you know, take this 30 years of my life and
never let it inform anything else I ever
exactly.
Do.
It's
yeah.
like I've lost the right now to speak about Mormonism because I don't go every Sunday now. So, so that's where that is. And yeah, so it's possible. It's possible. I've got a killer idea for a God's Army 3 of all things that I would love to make, and it would obviously be it's obviously very different from God's Army, but it's kind of the wrapping up of everything. It's kind of like Godfather 3, except it would be better because Godfather 3 was no good. But yeah, so there's even that, you know, which, and of course when you'd see the story, any intelligent person would realize that there's no conflict between my own personal beliefs at this point and telling the story. Because naturally I wouldn't be going in saying, and this means that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God and that Thomas Monson's a prophet, blah, 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 you know. They would just be stories about and have a lot to do with this.
With universal themes that just happen to take place with very right. Mormon, very particular characters.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Good storytelling. Yeah.
Right. And like I said,
and so you can still consider yourself a spiritual films is still your preferred genre if you could really
oh, yeah,
always
absolutely.
Work on that. You still want to wrestle with those kinds of things.
Oh, if I could spend my yeah. life just year after year making these, you know,
it had to do with the cosmic questions.
Exploratory explorations and expeditions. Yeah, I'd love it. That's absolutely what I want to do. And in fact, that, you know, we talked earlier about that was kind of the purpose of movies like Evil Angel was to give me the financial freedom that I could do this. And but one of the things I'm doing now is making, you know, making a movie like Triptych, which is incredibly, it's tiny, tiny budget film. And mostly it's just being made by me putting my own money into it and any friends, people who are willing to, you know, take a little risk. But it's along that same line where it's like I'm making a and Triptych, by we should mention this quickly before I leave, since that's what I'm working on now, is it's a story. It's basically I'm taking the concept of you know, triptychs, which were especially during the Renaissance and beforehand,
three panel
often altarpieces that would, you know, some the two side panels would fold in on the first one. So anyway, but it was, and they'd have to do with some scene, the crucifixion or one of the saints or whatever. And so what I wanted to do was make a cinematic kind of the equivalent of this, which is three stories that would be interwoven and are separate, but they all have a similar theme and similar imagery. And all three of these stories in this film, Triptych, have to do with, they're all, spiritually based stories and explorations. In fact, one of the stories that the central story, I still quite don't know how it ends yet because I'm still, one of the things is largely shot, another one I'm about to shoot, but then I'm letting this central story evolve like I did with Falling, where I'm not giving it a concrete ending yet because I want to see how it interplays. And frankly, I don't know where it goes. I don't know what the end of the road is because I'm asking a lot of questions that I don't have answers to.
Now, if I understand right, you're not necessarily looking for investors in Triptych as much as patrons. You would rather just have people donate money through Kickstarter.com that aren't looking to be paid back. Is that what you would say? Or you're willing to go either direction? I mean, you probably couldn't sell it to them as this will be a commercial blockbuster.
Yeah, and so that way the Kickstarter approach, it's a smaller amount of money and it's pretty upfront about, you're just helping me to get this made.
And, do you want to share a number that would be your dream to receive in the next week?
Oh, dream to receive in the next week?
for that film. I mean, again, we've had numbers to get Evil Angel distributed. All those are okay, so we'll just throw out different numbers and maybe we'll find somebody who says,
well,
I'm impressed with this guy.
To, if I found someone who was willing to donate or invest $10,000 in Triptych, that would be fantastic. We're talking about a very low budget movie here, so... And that would help me basically get the movie finished.
And then your goal would be a theatrical release?
Definitely a theatrical release.
Okay, so
yeah.
It would be at least high enough quality to play in a Cineplex?
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to do crap. And it's going to... I mean, most likely it'll play, in Salt Lake City, maybe Los Angeles or New York or something like that. But mostly it'll probably pay there and then immediately go to foreign markets and DVD. So very small, so it doesn't... It's not risking a lot of money, so a few foreign sales and you've already got your money back. But I think the important thing for me is this is the way that I'm dealing with the current way my career and world economics is going is, scale things down, go really into deep subjects and things that aren't being addressed or treated in any kind of films is could be potentially successful because there'll be an audience of people like the people that are listening to like this or that are interested in spiritual things that I think would really welcome something like a deep dark exploration of spirituality and that's
deep,
what
dark
well
just a deep
now this one's turning out to be deep and dark.
Okay.
At least one of the stories is turning out to be deep and dark and one of the stories, it's called The Boy Who Found Dead Things, and I've really just fallen in love with this little story. It's like a little short story of a movie, and I've just fallen in love with it. Beautiful little thing, a beautiful little story. So that's juxtaposed with something that's a little bit darker and more grown up in, spiritual terms. But that's something that's very important to me. It's like, I mean, how often do you get to have a kind of an actual grown-up adult discussion or exploration of spirituality in cinema? Just hardly ever happens. So I continue to be committed to that. And I'm sure at some point Mormonism will find its way back into that.
If these investments don't come, or if these grants or gifts or however you'd want to put it don't come, Main Street Movie Company has opened its doors to filming commercials.
Right.
What's on the menu of offerings that if somebody says, well, my company is looking to do this or that or the other thing,
right?
What types of things are you set up to do?
Well, that's one of the things we've set up to do, and something we're pursuing more now is just doing commercials. We have a lot of fun with the ones we've done so far. We've had a lot of fun with, again, it's like commercials aren't my calling in life, but if commercials, bring me a little revenue that I can put it into movies like Triptych, and again, that's what it's all about for me. It's like everything is, how do I keep making these movies? So yeah, anybody that's got a company that needs a commercial, that's another way to...
Any other projects? I mean, would you promotional videos, telling the company's story? Would you be willing to film those types of things too, or would you want to just stick with the really short 30 and 60?
Oh, we can do anything. Yeah, we can. Yeah, I mean, if it's like an industrial film, I may not personally be directing the
right.
the piece, but yeah, it can go through the company.
You could, okay, right. Yeah. You either have the people in-house, or you certainly have good relationships with people that could handle
right.
pretty much whatever the project would be.
Right.
Great. Right. Well, that's great to know. Now, Richard, I tell you, for those of you who don't know, we started around 6, and we're looking at 2 in the morning right now. So thank you for your stamina. Thank you for your openness, the generosity with which you've told your Mormon story and your universal story, and that you've given us a peek behind the curtain to so many wonderful things. And I love you more than I did when I walked in this room, which was already a lot. I just value you as a great friend and somebody who I've been blessed to get to know very much. So
seriously, what an opportunity to spend this much time talking about something that's this important and complex. So thanks for the invitation to do it in this forum, because and you've given me plenty of time and plenty of consideration. So if anything hasn't been communicated well, then that's just my own lack of eloquence, but yeah, I think we covered a lot. I'm happy with it.
We want to sell videos. We want to sell getting your commercial made by you. We want to sell some of these projects, some of the financial needs that you have as far as getting distribution for Evil Angel and opening
right.
the door to the other things. And so that certainly wasn't our main purpose or the reason for doing this, but I'm hoping that those in this audience who love you, who respect your talent, who still are pleading for you to, tell our stories or whatever it is. I know that it's going to touch some people out there, and they're going to buy the Dutcher collection, or they're going to, who knows what it is, maybe a Forbes 100 person will come forth and say, Joseph Smith, $15 million, no problem.
Well, that'd be nice.
Yeah,
that would be nice.
Great. Well, thank you again very much. Thank you to our listening audience, to our viewing audience who are seeing this on video. We have had a good time, and we've about exhausted ourselves.
Great.
So great. Thank you again.
Great. Good night.
Night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.